Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. My name is Savante Myrick. I'm from the class of 2009. Where's class of 2009? I'm surprised. I saw you guys at 4 a.m. last night. I'm very surprised to see you. But I'm here not because it's my fifth reunion. I'm here and it's my distinct pleasure to introduce you to President Dr. David Skorton. And I was invited here, I think, because I'm very eloquent. No, I was invited here because I'm the mayor of the city of Ithaca. And that's a nice What a nice crowd. I've never gotten that. That's usually, all right, well, thank you. I want to say that this is actually, for those of you who are familiar with such things, with town gown relations, having somebody in my position introduce someone in President Skorton's position is a pretty unusual thing. The leaders of these two organizations, the town and the gown, don't always see their interests aligned, and in some cases, that can lead to pretty high-profile conflict. But I want to say it's a testament to President Skorton that I was invited to speak here anyway. And I know he invited me for two reasons. One, because he's a consummate professional. He's somebody who understands the importance of maintaining a positive relationship through constant communication. And number two, he wanted me to stop having his car towed. I run the police department. I don't know. What do you want me to say? I can do those things. But before I get to the president, I do want to say, now some of you may not know this, but I was a Cal's alum. Yes. Where I studied communication. In 2007, when I was a junior here at Cornell, I ran for and won a seat on the Ithaca City Council. I served 4 years, and at 24, I was elected mayor. But what you may not know is that before I became mayor, I worked for the Office of Alumni Affairs for a year and a half. And actually left that job shortly after reunion due to nerves. No. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding, Margaret. I'm kidding. I left that job to run for mayor, and I have to tell you that I would not be standing here if it weren't for the things that I learned from the folks in Alumni Affairs. First, the ability to manage complex organizations. I mean, the ability to, what it takes to get thousands of Cornellians, you know what Cornellians is, right? Stubborn, type A, right? To get thousands of Cornellians to arrive at the same time, settle into campus, enjoy a weekend full of activities that appeal to people from the age 22 to the age 102, right? And leave at the same time without anybody hurting themselves or anyone else, is absolutely incredible. They learned, they taught me how to manage complex organizations. They also taught me how to manage difficult people. I don't know how to break this to you. You're difficult people. You are. You're hard to deal with. And it's good. It's a good thing I learned that because so are Ithacans. Ithacans are difficult people. You know, I was at a conference for the U.S. Conference of Mayors, 250 mayors from across the country. And each mayor was invited to say something about their city that the other mayors thought would be interesting. The mayor right before me is from Myrtle Beach. He stands up and he says, "We are a city of 100,000 people, and we have 25 golf courses." And all the mayors went, "Ooh." So I stand up and I said, I'm the mayor of Ithaca, New York. Last year, Ithaca was named the smartest city in the country. And all the mayors went, "Oh." So you know what that means. They know what that means. It's not pleasant. It's not fun a lot of times. So working in Alumni Affairs taught me how to deal with difficult people, but it taught me the most important thing that a leader has to know, the most important thing, and that is they taught me how to ask people for money. By the way, they have asked me to make an announcement today, which is that all events, this event and all events, are of course no admission to enter, but you will have to make a gift to leave. Tower Society or above, Ivy Society would also be very welcome. So You know, President Scorton, I don't want to recite to you his resume. I'm sure you already know it. I'm sure you know that in 2005, I arrived at Cornell as a freshman. In 2006, President Scorton arrived as our new president, and I've been teaching him the ropes ever since. he's come a long way. He's learned quite a bit. I've had the distinct privilege. You know that he's a brilliant MD. You've seen that he's a talented administrator, a gifted fundraiser, an excellent, I'm talking top 1% communicator. And I've seen all of this. I've got a front row seat as a student working through my fraternity, through my club activities. I had the privilege of watching President Scorton work and the honor of working alongside him as an alum. I've been privileged to see how much he cares about the alumni perspective, not just because I donate dozens of dollars per year. You're welcome. You're welcome, by the way, for that. How this place would, half of these flowers, this half is my gift. You're welcome for that. Yes, oh, thank you. But it's not our financial contribution. He actually understands that a place is about its present, its future, and its past, that the people who make Cornell strong are the people who come back year after year, reunion after reunion. I watched, as an employee, how much he truly cares about each one of his thousands of employees. And now as mayor, I've watched and learned. I've learned from his humility. I've learned from his humor. I've learned from his consistency. And I've learned more than anything from his honesty. He doesn't sugarcoat the bad news. Right? He's willing to share the good news. He's as transparent a leader as you could ever want. In an organization this complex, you have to believe me, that's more difficult than it sounds. He's somebody that those of us who live and work in this county every day look up to. And I have to tell you that while I couldn't be sadder that we'll be losing Dr. Scorton, I couldn't be happier. I'll tell you something about myself, and I don't want this to surprise you. And for those of you who know me well from class of 2009, this is going to come as a shock. I wasn't always this cool. I have two older brothers, both taller, handsomer, more athletic. I was pretty stumpy, and I've worn glasses as long as I can remember. Asthma, the whole nine yards. Not a pretty scene. So while they were breaking records, you know, I was struggling to find myself. And it was when I was 8 years old, my grandmother bought me a subscription to a magazine called Muse Magazine. And Muse is the magazine for kids and young adults created by the Smithsonian Institution. And I haven't told President Scorton this. When I was 12, she upgraded me to the Smithsonian Magazine. That piqued my curiosity. It introduced me to a world of thought, a world where I could do things that my body couldn't do, a world where I could explore things beyond our means would allow us to explore. And we didn't get to go a lot of places as a kid. I didn't get to go on a lot of vacations. One vacation we were able to take was to Washington, D.C., because the Smithsonian was free for admission. They didn't ask us for money. They didn't ask us to prove how poor we were before they let us in for free. We just walked through the door. The Smithsonian, those magazines, that institution changed my life and is a large part of the reason I ended up getting into a school as good as Cornell University. So I care about that place. And as sad as I am to see that President Scorton is leaving, I couldn't be more thrilled that another love of my life has such a good steward to lead it through its next transition. So I hope you'll join me in thanking and welcoming President David Scorton.
Thanks, all of you, and thank you, Mayor Myrick. And I just want to echo in all sincerity how much I've enjoyed working with you in easy days and bad days. And I want to tell you that Robert and I wanted you to know that if we didn't live in Cuyahoga Heights, there'd be a pretty good chance that we would have voted for you or somebody. So there's just no doubt about it. We would have been part of the democratic process. But we're in Cuyahoga Heights, so we've been mainly focusing on deer and other things. So anyway, appreciate you being here. Appreciate all the things that we've done together. And we still have another year together. So. Very kind of you about the Smithsonian. Well, you guys, whether you are celebrating your fifth reunion, like the mayor and the rest of the class of 09, or your 75th reunion, like Kip Kiplinger, Chair Emeritus of the Cornell Board of Trustees, oh yeah! Where are you? There he is. There he is. Woo! You know, Kip has already gotten Robin and me a special membership in the Cornell Club of Washington. We're all set to go. Well, anyway, whether you're in the 09 or the 39 group, or you're celebrating Reunion Zero with the class of 14 at just graduated less than 2 weeks ago, whether you're connecting again with your undergraduate class or a professional school or a special interest alumni association or the continuous reunion group, whether you're here in Bailey this morning or watching the live stream of this event from a location across the country or around the world, we are thrilled to have you here with us today on this spectacular Big Red Reunion weekend. Welcome home. Welcome home. Robin and I have been touched, really touched, by the outpouring of support and affection from Cornellians everywhere since it was announced that we'd be moving to Washington about a year from now. Moving to DC was a very, very hard choice for us. Very hard choice. The opportunity for us to work at the intersection of science and culture in the public interest was irresistible, but we're counting on staying in touch with all of you all the time, and I'm gonna keep my Cornell email so you can get a hold of me and complain about anything you want anytime. Well, what makes Cornell so memorable to so many? The answers are as varied as the alumni. For most of us, it seems to be a combination of remarkable people, faculty, staff, and students, the physical beauty of the campus and the surrounding area, the opportunities, personal and professional, that you've gained as Cornellians, no better example than Mayor Myrick, and our university's contributions to meeting the world's most difficult challenges. More about that later. People, of course, are the heart of Cornell. Our faculty members continue to be honored for their vision, teaching, and research. For example, we had another four faculty members just in the last year elected to the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, or the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And faculty excellence at Cornell, and one of the things very, very unusual about this university, it extends across disciplines and across academic ranks. Many of us yesterday heard our beloved senior colleagues, Glenn Altshuler and Isaac Kramnick, give their Olin lecture, "The Way We Were and Are." Was that something or what? It was amazing. We're all looking forward to seeing the publication of their book, Cornell, A History, 1940 to 2015, which will be out in September, but is available for pre-order right now on Amazon.com. And if I know Glenn Altshuler, probably as you're walking out of here today. Professor Stuart Schwab is completing a decade of service, distinguished service, as the Alan R. Tesler Dean of the Cornell Law School this month, and we'll be honoring and thanking him at a law school event tonight. And on July 1, We are going to welcome Eduardo Peñalver, class of 94, professor at the University of Chicago Law School, back to Cornell as our new law school dean. Yep. Eduardo, class of 94, joins Gretchen Ritter, class of 83, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and Catherine Bohr, class of 80, dean of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, proving once again the power that Cornell has, the magnetism, in drawing back its distinguished alumni to celebrate, to connect, and to lead. Three deans from Cornell. Amazing. Now, one of our newer faculty members, Kaitlyn Barrett, assistant professor of classics, was recognized last month with the Robert A. and Donna B. Paul Academic Advising Award for her work as director of undergraduate studies in archaeology, completely revising the undergraduate major and the undergraduate minor, resulting in an eightfold increase in students pursuing the degree of archaeology at Cornell. Jenny Mann, associate professor of English, who received this year's Robert and Helen Appel Fellowship for Humanists and Social Scientists, has offered workshops through the Center for Teaching Excellence, improved job placement support for English PhDs, a major challenge, and teaches an immensely popular course on utopias. We know what utopia is. It's reunion weekend. Recognizing their commitment to encouraging civic engagement in our students through service learning, we awarded this year's Kaplan Family Distinguished Faculty Fellowships to two faculty members, Deborah Castillo, the Emerson Hinchliffe Professor of Hispanic Studies and Professor of Comparative Literature, and Angela Gonzalez, Associate Professor of Developmental Sociology. And I am pleased to note that Barbara Kaplan, class of 59, who helped make these fellowships possible, is here this weekend celebrating her 55th reunion. Are you here, Barbara? Well, glad to hear it. So the faculty are a huge piece of why we keep coming back and coming back and coming back. Our staff members are also not only an integral part of the Cornell fabric, but an integral part of the Cornell excellence and of the student experience, and their contributions, our staff, are recognized not only here in Ithaca, but nationally and internationally. And to give one single example, Dr. Janet Corson-Reichert, Associate VP for Campus Health and Director of the University Health Services at Cornell, received the American College Health Association Ali B. Moten Award for her, quote, exceptional service and commitment to the field of college health. Because of student demand for health services and our facilities' wider importance to campus health, we are moving to update and expand the current building into a comprehensive university health center. Our students deserve nothing less, which we hope to complete in 2017. Well, that's the faculty and that's the staff, but of course we were put here in the first place, and every day we turn the lights on and open the doors for our students. And the students have also gained their share, more than their share, of academic honors, including two Marshall scholarships for graduate work in the United Kingdom and a whole variety of prestigious national awards. And how about Big Red Athletics? Oh, amazing. Six Ivy League titles, this is in case you didn't know what six was, Ivy League titles this year. Five medals at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. And how about that women's hockey team that won the gold? Sure, they were Canadian, but I mean, there was a lot of Cornellians on the team. And after all, they're our allies and everything, so it's fine. And a recent national championship for men's lightweight rowing. Such a long, wonderful tradition. Oh, yeah. Yep. Now, to get a fuller sense of what today's Cornell students are like, today's Cornell students, I invite you to look at the profiles of what we're called 19 incredibly impressive Cornell students that were in the publication Business Insider just this spring. These students are creating clinics and companies and new technologies and finding new species and producing videos to excite young people about math. And I have no doubt that some of these young men and women and many other Cornell students will continue to help change the world. And again, there's no better example than Mayor Myrick. We are pleased to extend the opportunities of a Cornell education to our newest students who will enter this August as the class of 2018. For the 3,200 spots in that class, we received the modest number of 43,000 applications. Still to this day, no Ivy Plus university gets this number of applications. It's amazing. Now, I was going to ask you to raise your hand if you would have made it past those odds. But I think the number of hands that are raised right now sort of tells the answer. If it was me, I would still be at the old man's shoe store. And that wouldn't have been so bad either. So one factor about Cornell that brings us back is the people, the people, the people. A second factor is the beauty of Cornell and Ithaca's natural and built environment. And I hope you'll take time to visit some of the beautiful areas off campus and on campus. And as you are on campus, I hope you'll see some of the new buildings, including Stocking Hall with a new and expanded dairy plant and a beautiful updated reincarnation of the beloved Dairy Bar. Oh, yeah. Many of you know that Robin and I constantly fight all the time, and this morning, on the way in, we had yet another fight. We're driving by the Dairy Bar, and I said, "You go and give the speech. I'm going to the Dairy Bar." And we had a big to-do, and if you want to know who won, well, here I am. Now, across from Barton Hall is Gates Hall, the new home of our Faculty of Computing and Information Sciences, which will be dedicated by Bill Gates this fall. It's a beautiful building, it's a functional building. And we are right now doing the first project 100% devoted to the humanities on this campus since 1905. Klarman Hall, done 100% through philanthropy, including a lead gift from Seth Klarman, class of 79, and Beth Klarman, for whom it is named. And that's the reason you can't drive down East Avenue right now. Now, that's Ithaca, the heart and soul, but not all of Cornell's footprints, as you know. And while Cornell Medical College in New York City, we have opened the 18-story Belfer Research Building, which is ushering in a new era of so-called translational medicine, in which scientific discoveries are translated into clinical work. And also in New York City, as you may have heard, a couple of years ago, we won a big contest to build a new campus in New York City. We beat them all. This is a campus for the information age, and under the leadership of Dan Huttenlocher and Kathy Dove and Kent Fox and Lance Collins, it is focusing on creating pioneering leaders and pioneering technologies for the new economy. Cornell NYC Tech, or as we affectionately call it, Cornell Tech, currently is operating from space donated by Google Inc. in their building in the Chelsea section of New York City on 8th Avenue and 15th Street. And we look forward to opening the first phase of the permanent campus on Roosevelt Island in the summer of 2017. So it's a fabulous, fabulous physical plant in Ithaca, in New York City, and many other places. Now, college affordability, of course, is not only an issue here at Cornell, not only an issue for colleges around the country, it's one of the nation's major issues. Cornell continues to make admissions decisions without regard for the ability of students or their families to pay, and then we award need-based financial aid. Currently, 50% of the undergraduates receive need-based aid from Cornell sources, and Cornell financial aid initiatives that were greatly intensified starting in 2008 just when they were needed, made Cornell more affordable for all aided undergraduates. And in fact, the median net cost of attendance of this university for this group of undergraduates who have need is lower today than it was 6 years ago when the recession began. But that's not because of me, that's because of you, because of your generosity and because of your caring and because of advice you sent me, that we have to take care of the students and leave the doors wide open. And how wide open are they? Your Cornell University is now the eighth most economically diverse undergraduate student body of national universities in the entire United States. Eighth most economically diverse. So I can't thank you enough for your contributions to everything at Cornell, your intellectual contributions, your financial contributions, your loyalty, your spiritual and your emotional contributions. I do want to thank you specifically for the contributions you've made to the fundraising campaign that's been going on since, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes after I got here. And the Cornell Now campaign, which originally the campaign was named something else, it was far above, was supposed to be $4 billion. We blasted by that. Then it was supposed to get to $4.75 billion. Thanks to you, it is at $4.7 billion right now, just about to cross that finish line. And if you add in the enormous generosity for Cornell Tech, we are now at $5.3 billion. Thank you. Thank you. And 161,000 alumni have participated. 161,000 alumni. And take it as genuine from my heart. Savante was making a joke about giving dozens of dollars. Every gift makes a palpable difference at this university. Every gift raises our sights. Every gift gives us more of an edge for excellence. 161,000 alumni, thank you. And we're very, very close to hitting the two most important goals of these campaigns. One is faculty renewal. Our goal was $50 million. We're past $47 million. And the goal for undergraduate scholarships is $350 million, and we're already at $327 million. And I'm totally confident we're going to get there. So in advance, I'm thanking you again. Now, this is a lot of the good news. What about the challenges? Do we have challenges? We have challenges aplenty. In the sesquicentennial year, it is worth remembering that for 150 years, Cornell and Cornellians have mobilized to tackle seemingly intractable real-world problems. And the commitment of Cornellians to contribute productively toward solutions remains as strong, indeed stronger than ever. Take one example, the issue of racial diversity and inclusion, which has been on the minds of many this year and on my mind because this year is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. And although Ezra Cornell and Andrew Dixon White both advocated for granting educational opportunity to people of all races, campus life for students of color was sometimes very harsh in the university's early years. Attitudes toward diversity began to change and gained steam in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s as part of a growing national awareness of civil rights, and Cornellians were part of that change. Among the participants in Freedom Summer 50 years ago in 1964, for example, were Michael Schwerner, class of 61, James Chaney, and Andrew Goodman, whose parents were both Cornellians. They were killed while attempting to register black voters in Mississippi 50 years ago this month. And their sacrifice is commemorated in a stained glass window in Sage Chapel, made possible by a gift from the class of 61. These are Cornellians. For much of our history, Cornell has tried, but let's admit it, albeit imperfectly, to insist on integration and an end to discrimination while fostering the dynamic and productive tension between assimilation on one hand and the affinities rooted in an individual's background and interests on the other. Some of the credit for our progress toward increased diversity and inclusion belongs to my predecessor, James A. Perkins, our seventh president. In 1964, with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, President Perkins established the Committee on Special Educational Projects, or COSEP, to help recruit African American students to Cornell, and as importantly, or more importantly than recruiting them, to support their success. During his presidency, enrollment from this group increased from 10 students to 250. Yes. And yet, some of those enrolled through COSEP felt apart, as did the earlier generations of black students on this campus. Those of you in the class of 1969 especially remember the tension between black and white students during your time here, which rocked the foundations of this institution, but also set the stage for productive change. And 20 years ago, Tom Jones, class of 69, one of the student leaders during the Perkins era, an emeritus Cornell trustee and member of this year's 45th reunion class, established the Perkins Prize for Interracial Understanding and Harmony in honor of President Perkins, and with the goal of encouraging greater understanding across difference. This year's winner, for example, was the Intergroup Dialogue Project, a course now offered across all Cornell colleges, where students learn through frank, constructive discussions about issues of conflict and community, including race, including gender, including religion, including sexual orientation, and including socioeconomic status. Thank you, Tom Jones. Do we have more work to do? Yes, we have more work to do. And in recent years, we have stepped up our efforts to address issues of diversity and inclusion. Just this last fall, the university launched a study of the campus climate for our students, and with the help of a team led by Professor Silvia Hurtado, a noted scholar from the University of California, Los Angeles, obtained both qualitative and quantitative data. While most students, happily, have positive perceptions of the Cornell experience, the Hurtado study found that the degree to which students feel included and respected and safe on this campus varies significantly depending upon their social identities. This study is already informing our work on the campus climate going forward. Another issue of growing concern nationally as well as at Cornell is sexual violence. Like racial bias, it is an issue on which we as a community and a nation must take a strong stand. Our broad-based Council on Sexual Violence Prevention, which includes faculty and students and staff and members of our local community, is strengthening efforts to prevent and respond effectively to sexual violence and to change the culture that permits this to exist. And thanks to our determination to tackle this issue, we were already well out in front among institutions of higher education when President Obama's White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault urged colleagues to take action to curb sexual violence that has long plagued schools around the country. And I want to recognize Vice President Mary Opperman and Vice President Susan Murphy for their important and unending work on this problem. Yes, for nearly a century and a half, Cornellians have attempted to address big problems while acting as custodians and disseminators of knowledge and promoting free inquiry with our unique combination of excellence in teaching and research and creative activity and public engagement and our unswerving commitment to student access. In addition to efforts to improve the campus climate that I focused on in this talk, we are also leading the way in changing the undergraduate curriculum and programs designed for the needs of today and the needs that we anticipate tomorrow, including a university-wide undergraduate business minor designed for students majoring in subject areas other than business to get exposure to business concepts and frameworks and methods, or the wide variety of hands-on team projects in the College of Engineering, building everything from Mars rovers to autonomous underwater vehicles to an on-campus sustainable research facility to explore new energy technologies and sustainable building practices. And the China and Asia Pacific Studies program designed to train future leaders who are equipped to address the inevitable challenges and negotiate the delicate complexities in the various domains of U.S.-China relations, which has benefited greatly from the vision and support of Mike Zack, class of 75, and Adam Levinson, class of 92, and many other alumni. Now, in 1967, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare John W. Gardner wrote an article in the American Bar Association Journal entitled, "A Nation Is Never Finished." The article covered civil rights and poverty and the decay of cities and threats to community cohesion, and it ended with these memorable words, "A nation is never finished. You can't build it and leave it standing as the pharaohs did the pyramids. It has to be recreated in each generation by believing, caring men and women. It is now our turn. If we don't believe or don't care, nothing can save the nation. If we believe and care, nothing can stop us. A great university like a great nation is never finished, and now it's our turn. Our sesquicentennial year will provide many opportunities here in Ithaca, in New York City, and around the country and world to look back at Cornell's past accomplishments, to celebrate current successes, and to chart that course for the future. As we together celebrate 150 years of extraordinary contribution, I invite you, each of you, to be part of the continuing conversation about difficult issues and help identify solutions that are the hallmarks of revolutionary and beloved Cornell. And as I welcome you home this weekend, I welcome you also to that larger task. Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, why don't we just end on that note, forget about this Q&A. Yeah, it's only gonna go south from here, that's for sure. Okay, where's Margaret? We have to stop now, right? No, we don't have to stop. Okay, thank you for nothing, that's good. Okay, we have time for questions. We have microphones in the aisles down here in the, the orchestra? And we have microphones up there. You can just yell at me. So please, anything you'd like to hear about, topics I covered, anything. I'm stalling, ma'am, so we don't have to get to your question. But any little things you want to talk about. We have 7 colleges. Shall I name this? Never mind.
Thank you, President Scorton. And as a member of someone who lives in the DC greater area, I'm glad you're coming to the nation's capital, where I know Cornell's reach will go far beyond, because I know once you leave Cornell, it doesn't leave you. I wish I were still a student, but alas, I am not. However, I know that I will always be a Cornellian. And I was wondering, as an alum, what can I do to help Cornell make it better? I know I haven't made my first billion yet. I'm working on that. But I want to help, because I think that we can be, as alumni, more united. So I don't know if you could share thoughts on building the community in the world.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you. What a great question. So I'm going to say something, and you're going to wonder if I'm sincere about it, but don't worry about your first billion. Don't worry about your first billion. The best thing you can do to help us do better, the very best thing is to criticize us, to let us know how you think we could be doing better. Why is that? Because you have one foot on this campus and your heart's still on this campus, but your other foot is somewhere out in the world and you've learned what we did to prepare you well, what we could have done better. And because you view us with a clarity of vision and a certain love, you can give us tough love. So I give all the alumni my private email. Now the vice presidents and deans hate when I give my email out because they know what's gonna happen. You're gonna write me and I'm gonna forward it to them to figure out what to say. But you know, I really only have three perks as being president here. They're major perks. One is my email address does not have a number on it. It's just david.scorton@cornell.edu. So write me with any thoughts you have and tell your pals your pals in Washington can just tell me when I get there, but everybody else can write. The second perk is I can park anywhere I want. I can park in the dean's spots, the vice president's, anything I want. And the third perk, I just can't tell you what it is, but it's a really fabulous perk. So just absolutely positively, the best thing alumni can do is to get in our face in a constructive way. Once in a while, it wouldn't break my heart if you said, well, you're doing great, you know, but I wouldn't believe it was Cornelian. So please tell us what you think. Be heard. That's the best thing you can do. Yep.
So those of you who know me, I bleed Cornell red. I drive around with a license plate that says CU84. I wear red routinely, not just at reunion. I recently had to counsel a friend's child not to come here because he was accepted to a Canadian university that was going to cost him $6,000.
Yeah.
Cornell was going to cost him $65,000. How are we closing that gap where highly, highly capable students, yeah, who really belong here and would benefit from this education can actually come here?
This is the toughest question anybody could ask me. I'm glad you asked. I'm glad you asked. So, bear with me. I'm going to give you a complete answer because it's a complicated subject. So, number one, for people, just because you mentioned Canada, just even though I know that wasn't the thrust of the question, for students from other countries, we have a long way to go for undergraduates. Graduates, a different story. Because the vast majority of our financial aid is applicable to domestic students and much more philanthropy in that regard. And so we have a big hill to climb for international undergraduates. We are making some progress. And so let's just say that we have a big hill to climb. For Americans, which is about 78% of the undergraduate, of the overall campus, excuse me, about 90% of the undergraduates. Here's the story. So the median family household income in the U.S. is in the low 60s. Let's call it 63, roughly. So roughly, that's the median. Roughly half the families in America can come here, assuming that they don't have other big assets somewhere, with no loans and no parental contribution. Half the families in America. And beyond that, families that meet our definition of need, it's a complex definition, will have their very substantial financial aid. And as I've mentioned to you, that whole population, it costs less to go here now than it did 6 years ago. Still, it costs a lot of money, but less than it did. So for people who have very significant demonstrated need, we've come a long way on the campus. Have we come far enough? I think we're not doing badly, to be very honest with you. I'm a first-generation college student. The average debt burden in the United States is in the low 30s, $33,000, $32,000. It's a lot of money. Whether it's too much money to pay $30,000 for 4 years of an education, it's less. The average debt is less here. It's in the 20s. I don't think it's too much, but you could disagree with me about that. At the upper end of the income range where I am, people can afford to pay cash, and I make no bones about it. I think it's a good investment. Everybody has to make their own decision. But there is that gap between how we define need and families who can afford to pay whatever it comes out to be, $1,400 a week or something like that to go to Cornell if you get no help. And we're closing that gap. in two ways, but we haven't closed it. We haven't come close to closing it. One way is that we're constantly raising more student financial aid, and we're sort of as far up on the income ladder in terms of the need definition as we can go right now. But we have closed that to some extent, and we're trying to push it a little harder. And the second is the leaders of the campus, the provosts and the vice presidents and the deans, are trying very, very hard to reduce the cost of opening the doors in the morning. This is very easy to say. It's very hard to do. We have reduced the staff workforce by nearly 9% since the recession. We've eliminated two vice presidencies, which didn't break anybody's heart. We have greatly worked to reduce needless redundancies and so on and so forth. I'm not a big business expert. I don't think we have any more room here to reduce the staff workforce. I think there are still some redundancies we could do. We spend a lot of money on capital projects. Maybe we could slow down the campus beautification and the building of buildings. I think we do need to still spend money on upgrading buildings and on changing things to be more energy sustainable. So we're trying to do both things at Cornell, but we're not going to get all the way around the bases. And it's unlikely the way things are right now that we're going to get help from the federal government too much. We're going to fight hard to try to make sure that Pell Grants stay as robust as they can, but it's a constant challenge. And that's as much as I can tell you, an honest appraisal of where we are now. So, you know, keep at us about this. Anybody up there? You want to get another golf course, huh? I can't blame you. Oh, here's one. Nobody upstairs, okay?
Yep.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Brother?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm almost done, you know. It's great.
Well, yeah, well, yeah. Well, I threw a couple of tough ones to you, especially about 4 years ago. Not a tough one. I commented on how Dean Schwab at the law school, where I was class in 1950, was doing a great job. But then we were, of course, looking ahead toward a new deanship, and I raised some hopes and expectations there, which have been fully met. The university, yourself included, is bringing in an incredible new dean at the law school, Eduardo Weber. Then 2 years ago, having noticed in the Cornell Sun reunion issue about how you and the provost had expressed wishes for even higher excellence for the Africana Studies program here at Cornell, including moving toward having a doctorate, I raised that issue, and I'm throwing that back to you for any possible updates. And finally, recalling that you have talked about Cornell University as the land-grant university to the world, now you're moving to a position in Washington where you have an even better prospect of delivering on that hope. So maybe you can talk about how Cornell University can be part of a more globally responsible world.
Okay, because of the timing, I'm gonna pick out two of these real quick, and I'll give you short answers. And if you want a longer answer, jot me a line and I'll send you a longer answer. An Africana, I was and am 1,000% in favor of the provost's decision to put a distinguished academic unit where all academic units are in this university, and that is in colleges. And since then, the provost has made good on his pledge to put more money in the program, start a PhD program, and to do more faculty hiring. So I think that the future is bright for Africana. It's an extraordinarily important part of the university. And thank you, it's an extraordinarily important thing to talk about today in this state. And in terms of the land-grant university to the world, there's so much going on here that literally I could talk with you about it for a half hour easily. I'm going to ask you to jot me a note to David Dotskorton, and I'm going to send you back a link to a document that was produced by Professor Fred Logaval, who's our Vice Provost for International Affairs. Is that the right title? I always forget. Okay. And he has a very well-focused, incisive plan for regaining. Cornell's always been international, always been in leadership, but regaining an even stronger leadership. And I hope and think you'll be impressed, but when you read the link, write me, I'll send you the link. When you read the link, come back and let me know. And before we end today and sing together, I want to just say one more time how much Robin and I appreciate all of your support and how much I appreciate everything you do every day for this university and this community. Bless you all and thank you.
Your president, our president, David Sporting. You guys can tag yourselves in that later. Now, I hope you'll join me in welcoming to the stage some very, very talented young people. Please welcome the Hangovers and After Eight.